Okay. One of the things we're trying to do by observing Shabbat is actually go back to the first Shabbat that God kept, if you will. What does the word Shabbat actually mean? Because until now, we've had three classes about Shabbat. We've talked about all the positive things. What I want to start with you tonight is dive into what the things we don't do. Now, it's a lot easier to sell the don'ts than it ever was for me. I was always shy about sharing the don'ts because it sounds very restrictive. You have to turn your phone off. You can't get in the car and you can't do this, that, and the other. Now it's actually really in. It's like a whole part of the mindfulness craze and, you know, technology, you know, digital detox. But the idea of imitating God is a very important concept, not only in Judaism, but in most faith systems. We look, that's really the Torah. What do we care what God does so much? Because God's behavior is something we want to model. So God creates, we create. God rests, we rest. And it's not just like, and that's really what I want to get into with you tonight. When we talk about rest and the way God rested, it's something much deeper than simply, I'm tired, I work hard all week, I need a crash on Shabbos. It's okay to crash, but if your Shabbos is just about crashing and just stopping from what the rest of what you're doing and not achieving something positive through the negative. Does anybody know what are we trying to actually achieve when we rest on Shabbat? It's actually something positive. The word Shabbat, yeah, Miranda?
Isn't it like we work all week, so we have to rest like at the same level as God? Like we kinda we're working all week, and then if we work on Shabbat, it's like we're at the same level of like power and creation of God, so it's like kind of
Yeah, so there is a big thing about humility, about letting go. There's a little arrogance, and I'm not sure if we think this, but there's a little arrogance in thinking that if I don't continue to work, and I feel that I have a little founder syndrome with MJE, and a lot of people who start non-for-profits or businesses have this, like, the place can't go on without me. Like, if I'm not here, it's not going to happen. And there's a little syndrome that many people have. It's the yuppie part of us that it really loves to conquer and loves to make the world a better place and go out there and like, I'm sorry, but my business cannot survive if I don't take off one. You know, it won't work. And there's no sense of the other. Because what that presupposes is that you're the only force that's actually making something happen. By pulling back once a week and the world continues to run, what do we really say? We're saying that the whole week God is involved. It's just that I need to shine a light on God once a week by pulling back. Hashem wants us to create. Hashem wants us to, it says in the Torah, Sheshit Yamim Tavod, 6 days you shall work, Ubashvi'i, and on the seventh, Shabbat should be a Shabbos. Right? If we keep working all the time, besides losing a sense of who we are and our purpose and our mission and having that perspective, looking back at the week and looking, what am I doing with my life? Forget all that. But what are we really saying about God? We're saying we don't really need you. The world is, as long as I continue to work, things will continue. The minute I stop, everything comes to an end. No, by pulling back, it's a very humbling thought. We're basically turning the world back to God. And we're saying, you know what? We believe that no matter how much effort we exert, no matter how much we produce all week, no matter how much we manipulate the physical world and make the world a better place, which is what God wants us to do all week, we still believe there's another force at play. You know, somebody once asked me, why do we pray for a good livelihood? We're going to get to our... I used to teach a course on prayer to ninth graders on the Upper East Side. And one of the kids raised his hand and he says, I don't get it. Why are we praying that God give us... If you're smart, is what he said, and you work really hard, you get a good job, you'll make a lot of money. If you're not so smart or you're lazy and you don't work hard, you won't. What are you asking God for help? Now, I asked the rest of the class, how many of you guys agree with that? And almost every hand went up, because they live in the Upper East Side. Yeah, it was a little cute. And I said, guys, a little. And I said, guys, there are very smart, ambitious people unemployed. How's that? Because we need God's blessing. And just because you do everything you're supposed to do doesn't mean what the world, you'll see, as you grow up, you do everything you're supposed to do, and not everything always works out. We need Hashem's blessing. And that's what we're acknowledging by pulling back once a week. Let me just say one other thing, Maria, and then I'll take your question. What does the word Shabbat actually literally mean?
He rested.
Okay, rested, but shevet means what? To sit. Bevakasha lashevet. Please, have a seat. What does it mean, sit? So the Kabbalah teaches that all week long, the physical and the spiritual are at odds with each other, even within us. But once a week, on Shabbos, the physical and the spiritual worlds somehow coalesce and live side by side, peacefully, harmoniously. And we're trying to tap into that energy. We're trying to tap into a certain peace between the tension that otherwise exists between the physical and the spiritual. And that is that's a very, very powerful thing to do. And the only way you can do that is by letting everything drop, basically, and then trying to get into that energy. So it's not just like, I'm so tired, I can't wait till Shabbos, so I can do nothing. Okay, we just spent the last 3 weeks about all the somethings that we do on Shabbos. Why do we light candles? Why do we make Havdalah at the end? Why do we make Kiddush? Why do we have those three meals? And, you know, Shabbos is very active, actually. You're not really sitting there doing nothing. Now, you have a little more time to take a nap, sleep a little more. Not too late Saturday morning. You know, and just have a little more chill down time. But you can do that on Sunday. I always say, like, what's the difference between going to the mall? Well, the way we take off on a Sunday and the way we take off as Jews on a Saturday. Right? Very big difference. Very, very big difference. That's not rest. And not just because it takes effort to schlep around the mall. Because we are trying to tap into that spiritual energy. And I want to read something with you. Let's take two questions first, Maria, then Jason. Yeah. Just speak loudly, so, yeah.
So you were talking about the kids, and they're like, if you're like, work hard and you're smart, you're going to be okay, and you told them that how many smart people there are, and they're still not doing that good.
Well, not always, you know.
But, like, sometimes.
Yeah.
But how many people are there that are smart and that believe and also are not doing so great?
Right. That was my point.
No, but they also believe. They're also asking for...
Right. Well, just because we ask doesn't mean we get.
But, yeah. Like, if they do all of it, like, they do both sides. Like, they work, they...
We don't really know exactly. I don't pretend to be able to say that. A lot of people who have gone through the years at MGE and have become religious will sometimes get hit with a really difficult life situation. And they'll turn to me and they say, Rabbi, I don't understand. I became religious. You're laughing, but like, I became religious. Like, I don't understand. How could someone, God forbid, die in my family if I became religious? How could I lose my job? How could I not get that raise if I keep Shabbos now? I did my bit. It's time for God to do His. That is a human way of understanding things, but it's not, there's no basis for that. We keep the Torah because we think it's true and we think it'll make our lives better. We don't keep the Torah because we think, and this could be a, you know, maybe this upsets you, because if I do everything I'm supposed to do, God, my life's going to be perfect. Now, the reason I can still have faith in God and still say that is because I do believe that this world in which we live is not the only world. We believe in a world to come. We believe in the Messianic era. We believe in a much bigger existence. And this physical world in which we live is just one phase. So the fact that you might have a righteous person keeping lots of Torah and mitzvot and not getting his or her prayers answered favorably doesn't mean, you know, that shouldn't shake our faith. Intellectually, it does emotionally, of course. Because we emotionally feel like if we're doing the Torah, God should be doing for us. But it's much more complicated than that. And no one, I have, unfortunately, many stories of some extraordinarily righteous, religious, devout people who really had a very, very difficult life. And they didn't give up their faith. You know, we had a Holocaust survivor here, Mr. Burian. He passed away last year. He was the only one who got up and spoke for an hour and a half, and nobody stopped him, because you don't stop a Holocaust survivor when they're telling their story. And at the end of the lecture, I was about to let everybody go, because it was late. I was in this room, and someone raised their hand. I was like, it's like, after everything you saw and you just told us, how do you continue to be religious? And I'll never forget the answer he gave. His son, by the way, is a friend of mine, Lawrence Buren, just sent me his father's, the book that the family wrote of his father's stories. And he leaned forward, he was standing right over there, and he said, he turned to the student who asked, he said, because I really like it. I like being Jewish, and I love Torah, and I like keeping the mitzvah. And I'm not going to let Hitler take that from me, just because I have questions. And I found that to be a very honest answer. You know, now he could have become more theological and say, well, you know, bad things happen to good people, and that doesn't mean I was being punished, and that doesn't, you know, we could give intellectual answers, but it was an emotional answer, which is like, I like being Jewish. I like living this Torah life. We do it because we fall in love with it, or, hopefully it's a little of both, we think it's the truth. We believe that there's a God, and that God has commanded us to keep these things, so I want to follow what God has to say. Yeah, Allie.
Do you think there's anything to be said about keeping the mitzvot and God, like, tightening your relationship with God?
100%.
Receptive to your prayers?
We believe that. We believe that. We believe that God acts more providentially to people who have more of God in their life.
Okay. That's what my conversation said tonight. She said God controls everything except for the amount we see Him.
Right, well, the more we see and the more we involve ourselves in Hashem, or the more we involve God in our lives, whatever that means, let's say it's through the Torah, the more we believe that we are part of, it's not just a good and bad, that we make ourselves more worthy, but we're more within God's orbit. It's almost like a student in a classroom. Like if the student sits in the back, doesn't say anything, and then the teacher is, you know, grading the exams at the end of the semester, and like not sure about this, but they don't know that the student never spoke up, they never had any meetings, they don't know each other. Now, that's analogy is not really perfect there. But we do believe that hashkacha, which means God's providence, applies more to people that are more involved with God than not.
Fear of God.
Right.
Right. So if we don't have, that's something that we have to build up within ourselves.
That's a total choice. That's a total
right.
choice. And it's hard. Look, the whole book of Job. Has anyone studied the book of Job? So the book of Job is a whole exercise in why bad things happen to good people. And will Job continue to believe in God and worship and connect with God even though his life is going terribly? And by the way, that's very hard on an emotional level. That's why I don't get into theological discussions with people in pain. You know, somebody just called, his father passed away, and his mother just died, Al Cohn, who used to come to MG for a long time, and just going through a really, really rough time and has all these questions. It's sometimes not helpful, having been through some of this myself. Because we, like Maria, like what you were pointing out, like from our perspective, like if I do for you, you should do for me. But God has a much bigger picture that goes way beyond what we see. You had a question, Jason?
I was just going to bring it back to the Shabbat.
Yeah, let's bring it back to Shabbat.
The original question was about like what are we trying to do on Shabbat if we don't have Kabbalah. There's another insight from a couple of teachings about concealedness, and that usually during the week they're very much separated. It's harder to see God, but on or the divine, the worldly. But on Shabbat, one of the layers is removed, and we become closer. And so the purpose of it is thus to connect us to the source of things, which are usually a little bit more hidden under the callus of our everyday
right.
Existence.
So let me ask you, why is it easier to see? I mean, just ask yourself: is it easier to feel a little more of God in your life on Shabbos? I would say most people would say yes if you're doing some Shabbos. Because why? It's what we're about to go in. Because you're pulling back from what specifically?
The ego.
It's the ego. It's not just physical labor. It's a lot of the ego. We're handing the world back. Kind of Miranda was alluding to it before. We're handing the world back over to God and saying, this place was always yours. And by the way, as technology, thankfully, marches on, okay, we can kind of feel as though we need God less and less and less. We can continue, we can control more and more of our own. Once in a while, something like COVID, I think, comes along and reminds us we haven't quite figured it all out yet. You know, but I do think that by just cutting out all of the manipulation that we do all week long, I don't mean manipulation in a bad way. And that's what we're going to get into. What is a malacha? What are the things we're not supposed to do on Shabbos? Okay, so follow with me on page 12. Just skip to page 12, Ari. Let me just jump in because it's late. What is malacha? So from now on, I don't want to use the word work anymore. Because every time I say we don't work on Shabbos, it conjures up this idea of a bunch of unemployed people on Saturdays. Okay, it's much deeper than that. In fact, is going to work on Shabbos prohibited? Not in the Torah. Very good. Not biblically. Unless you needed to drive there. But actually working is a rabbinic prohibition that you might come to do one of the 39 acts of work, like writing or any of the other things that are, you know, we normally do at work. But follow with me. What is malacha? This book is from Diane Grunfeld, who's a great Jewish judge in England. Considered himself a student intellectually of the late and great Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, great German Jewish philosopher, and he asks the question, he says, what is malacha? How is the Sabbath to be observed to ensure that its sublime purpose may be realized in the Jewish soul? And the Torah's answer is unmistakable. As we have seen, it's by refraining from work. The very name Shabbat means this, you shall do no manner of work. Again, and again, the Torah insists as the first condition, the center and essence of the Sabbath observance. Now the question is, how do we define it? Okay. Now some of you know some of this, but this is my favorite description of the concept of malacha, of the 39 acts of work. It's clear that work, or to use the Torah's own term, malacha, is by no means identical with physical strain or exertion. This is shown by the simple legal fact that you are not a Sabbath breaker if you carry a heavy load inside your house, but if you carry even a small book from your house into the street with no Erev, then you would be profaning the Sabbath. So how is that? You see all those chairs and all these, if I took all of these on Shabbos, let's say it was Shabbos right now, and I moved around all the chairs and the couch over there, I thought it would look better over there, and I set the whole room up with 10 tables and I set all the 10 tables and we had a big beautiful Shabbat dinner and then everybody left and I cleaned up and I'm exhausted and I'm like, oh, have I worked on Shabbos? No. But if I go over to that little light switch, because it's dark, and I flick it on, somehow I have. So it obviously has nothing to do with the physical exertion of labor. What is it, though? The Sabbath laws include this, right? Nor is it true to say that what the Torah forbids is merely the carrying on of our everyday occupations. The Sabbath laws include this, but they include far more besides. And it's clear they must be based on some different principle. So what is really meant by work? Take a look on the bottom. Skip to the bottom. The main source in the Torah for the definition of malacha is the command that all the various activities necessary for the construction of the sanctuary in the desert should cease on Shabbat. Now, before I go through these, what was the sanctuary? I want everyone to have clarity on this. The Mishkan. The Mishkan came before the temple or after the temple? Before. It's what God commanded Moses and the children of Israel in the wilderness to build. And what was the purpose and function of that Mishkan in the wilderness? What did they do? What was it used for? They would come and bring offerings, sacrifices. Moses would receive prophecy. According to many opinions, a lot of the Torah was revealed to Moses in the sanctuary, in the Mishkan. It was portable. There was a very sophisticated system of how to take it apart, put it back together. And why would they have to do that? Because they kept moving. And it was mobile. And every single activity that went into breaking it apart, putting it back together, or maintaining it physically is the way we to this day define what we don't do on Shabbos, called a malacha. And those are the 39 acts of work. Now, I have a different sheet for you if you would like to just look briefly. Here, just grab that, pass it around. That explains the 39 acts of work. You don't have to be an expert on this. Take a look. It says on the top, the following is a list of the 39 avot melachot which are prohibited on Shabbat. And you say, well, I don't understand. What, they did this in the Mishkan? They did that in the Mishkan? Like, what's the deal? To take a look, the first 11 malachos were performed either for manufacturing dyes. Why did they need dyes in the Mishkan? D-Y-E-S. Have you ever seen any pictures? I should have brought my Mishkan book. We have pictures. Well, not of the actual Mishkan, but of the... they have models in Jerusalem. What's that?
It's like putting up tapestries.
They have beautiful tapestries. And not simply for aesthetics, but to separate the different parts of the tabernacle. And they would make loaves of bread. Why? The Kohanim were like chefs, bakers?
The showbread.
The showbreads. It was called the Lechem Hapanim. That had to be on what was called the Shulchan all the time. And they were freshly baked challah loaves on this part of the tabernacle called the Shulchan. So the first 11 activities of the 39 are all the activities that go into baking bread or to creating dyes for the tapestries. What are they? Plowing, reaping, sowing, reaping, gathering, binding. I know none of us know this, but like when you go buy a loaf of bread in the supermarket, somebody had to do this, okay? Somebody had to actually plow the ground. So what's plowing? What is plowing? And you'll say, well, what the heck does this have to do with me today? Clearly, I don't bake bread on Shabbos, so I don't have a problem with any of this. But what is plowing? Let's take
the rows.
What's that?
Creating the rows.
Yeah, you're turning over the topsoil to make it fertile for planting a seed. So, okay, I won't do that on Shabbos, Rabbi. But how is that practical and relevant? So I think I gave this example, maybe. So like you're in Central Park with your buddies on Shabbat, hanging out with all the Jews on Saturday afternoon. That's still happening even in COVID, yeah? So a bunch of people are standing and you're getting tired, you want to sit down. So you see like one of those great Central Park benches. It's a little heavy, but you know what, I'm just going to schlep it over so that I can sit with my friends. So I start schlepping the thing like this. What have I just done? Now I'm not trying to plant seeds in Central Park. I'm just trying to schlep the bench over there so I can hang out with my buddies. But it doesn't matter. Now, it's probably not biblically prohibited to do that, because in order for something to be biblically prohibited, you have to be doing it with the intention of producing whatever it is they were producing in the tabernacle. You're clearly not doing that, but you're still doing the activity. The activity is the very activity that we are supposed to refrain from engaging on Shabbat. And therefore, pulling it across, if it's heavy. If it's not so heavy, and that's why you get rabbis coming in, if it's not so heavy, it's not really turning over. And what about a carriage? You ever see like a Sabbath observant mom or dad with their baby carriage? That's never a problem, because if you actually observe the way that the wheels turn, right, they're pushing the ground down. If you get a kind of carriage that it pulls the ground up, could be an issue. Some people don't like wearing heels on Shabbat, you know, in the park as a result. Probably not a good idea anyway, but because are you pulling grass, are you pulling up? If you're pushing down, it's not a problem. If you're pulling up, it is. It's very technical. I just wanted to give you a little example. Yeah, Hannah.
I mean, I understand the distinction, like the difference between the two, but just based on like coming out of someone who doesn't understand why we would do things that don't apply like thousands of years later, like, what would you say as the answer to
good.
Why would we do just the same activity
good.
If it's different?
It's a great question. And that's what this article is about. Yeah, so no, it's... No, no, we're going to read it together. We're doing it now. So take a look at 14 on the left. Goes through the 39 acts of work. I just wanted to use this other sheet to show that there are groupings, that there are groupings of these 39 acts of work depending on what was needed to get done in the tabernacle. So I just gave you the first 11. The next 13 are related to the manufacturing of wool. First five were in processing the wool. The next eight in making of the tent covering. And so on and so forth. Fine. Let's turn to, look at 15 on top. If we examine this list, we discover a surprising fact. Everyone with me? They are seen, Ethan, Skylar, you guys with me? You all right? Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, excellent. They are seen to form a cross-section of all the main types of human productive activity. This could hardly be accidental. In other words, if you look at the 39 activities that went into the building and breaking down or putting back up the tabernacle, they seem to be a cross-section of human productive activity. Now, this could hardly be accidental. However, it's not for our purpose to inquire to possible reasons for this, as far as the building of the sanctuary is concerned. What does concern us is that the Torah has given us a clear indication of the scope of malacha. In addition, certain types of malacha are mentioned independently in the Torah. Anybody know the two malachot that the Torah explicitly mentions not to do on Shabbat? Not to light a fire, and not to carry, actually, on Shabbat. Okay, well, I'll come back to those. Now, what is the idea behind it? And Hannah, I think this will answer your question. The written law thus gives the outline of the Sabbath legislation. The oral tradition, we've all studied this, has only to fill in the details by defining terms and applying the given principles to all the practical questions which arise in everyday life. For all practical purposes, therefore, recourse had to be had to the oral tradition, the halakha. Last paragraph. Every student of the halakha can see for himself the vast logically constructed system of the Sabbath laws. The more deeply he studies, the more it will be borne on him that it is indeed a system, not a haphazard mass of laws, but a consistent, coordinate body of legislation. What then is the underlying principle? Next paragraph, which underlines malacha. And he keeps asking, and he says, I'm going to give you an answer based on my teacher, Rabbi Hirsch. Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch lived in the 1800s in Germany. He actually lived in the beginnings of when the Reform movement was developing. And he wrote a lot of incredible... He had nothing to do with the Reform movement. He was actually very opposed to the Reform movement, but he was also very broadly educated and was pushing the Jewish community to be very well versed in secular studies at the same time. It's a fascinating personality. And this is Rav Hirsch's theory, okay, as to really the pertinence and relevance of these 39 acts of work today. In arriving at this interpretation of Malacha, Rav Hirsch starts with the basic idea that the Sabbath testifies to God as the supreme creator of heaven and earth. Right, we've talked about that. Right, by us keeping Shabbat, we're basically saying there's a God who created, there's a God who rested. What are you doing? Remember we said last week that there's a custom to stand for Kiddush on Friday night. Why do you stand? I think I mentioned this last week. Because a Jewish person giving testimony, being a witness in a court, a Jewish court of law, has to stand. And we, by making Kiddush, are bearing testimony of God, of His creation of the world, and of His resting. So man, however, is engaged in a constant struggle to gain mastery over God's creation, to bring nature under His control. And we're just talking about science. What is science trying to do, ultimately? What are we trying to do by developing technology? We're trying to control the world around us and not be controlled by it. Right? What are we trying to do when we get a vaccine? It's the worst thing in the world to be subject to the whims of nature. I mean, the whole world just got a huge dose of it, called COVID. Where, with all of our sophistication and erudition, we can't fight this little virus we can't even see. We're trying, and to the degree we're doing some of it, we feel good. To the degree we fail, we feel like a little creature that has no control. And we're supposed to do that when God says to work. That's what He wants us to do. God purposely created an imperfect, incomplete world, and He put us in it to make it better, to fix the world. And we are therefore in this constant struggle to gain mastery over God's creation, to bring nature under His control. By use of His God-given intelligence, skill, and energy, He has in large measure succeeded mankind, humankind. He is thus constantly in danger of forgetting His own creaturehood, His utter and complete dependence on the Lord of all things. He tends to forget that the very powers He uses in His conquest of nature are derived from His Creator. That's what bothers me so much about becoming such an erudite scientist. The scientist is using his God-given intelligence. He's using the world that God created. And he's using... Now, I'm not trying to say anyone's doing anything or saying anything purposely. Scientists are being sincere. They just don't... They weren't raised to believe in God. Not everybody. Many scientists do, of course. But the whole point is to bring God's world under our dominion. In a world increasingly forgetful of God, middle paragraph, Israel, that's us, was entrusted with the task of preserving the all-important truth for the future salvation of mankind. God willed, therefore, that the Jew, while subduing and controlling his environment, like every other human being, At the same time, we have to recognize and show that we recognize that our powers are derived from a higher power. This recognition he is to express by dedicating one day every week to God, and by refraining from what? From any activity that signifies human power over nature. Any activity that signifies human power over nature. We renounce on this day every exercise of intelligent, purposeful control of natural objects and forces. We cease from every act of human power in order, top of the next page, to proclaim God as the source of all power. By refraining from human creating, the Jew pays silent homage to the Creator, capital C. The essential characteristic of human creativity is the intelligent purpose which directs it. And by the way, Hannah, this is what I would say. Why am I not schlepping that bench across Central Park? How is that relevant? Because that is an activity that allows me to manipulate the natural world. Now I'm supposed to do that because I can't get bread if I can't plow the ground. You can't put a seed into the ground that hasn't been worked over a little. It's not going to grow. Hashem wants us to do that. But if we only do that, and one day a week we don't turn the world back to God and say, you know what, I'm not going to do any of these activities, the world's still going to go on, demonstrating that there is in fact a God, and that's really our job, that's our mission. If you choose to accept it, your mission is to shine a light on God and to declare His existence. And you can get up on a soapbox and, you know, on 42nd Street and preach, but the best way to teach, and I'll tell you this as a parent, is by your own behavior. Children often ignore what their parents have to say, but often ape and mimic what they do. Okay, talk is cheap, kids know it. Most people know it. But if you see someone living their life in a certain way, that somehow, even if people don't agree with it, but it allows people to look at it and to observe it. The world is supposed to be looking at the Jew keeping Shabbos and going, that's interesting. The essential characteristic of human creativity is the intelligent purpose which directs it. This then is the import of the fundamental halachic principle which forms the basis of the whole of the Sabbath law, Melechet Machshevet Asra Torah, that's Hebrew 4. The Torah forbids melacha, the realization of an intelligent purpose by practical skill. Which is why, if I didn't do this deliberately to turn the soil over, you can't really say that I violated on the biblical level a melacha. The rabbis still forbade it, because the activity itself is problematic. We want to stay away from those activities, even though I'm not using that activity for that goal. But even the activity itself, we try to stay away from. This too is the meaning of the principle, otherwise obscure, which states that any act of pure destruction, however strenuous, is not a malacha. The Gemara says, call him a kalkalin paturin. Anything that destroys, you're patur. You're not in violation of the Sabbath. Thus, if you were to knock down a building, simply with the idea of destroying it, now let's say you knock down a building because you want to lay the foundation for a new structure, that's a problem. But if you're knocking down the building just because, to get rid of it, that's not a malacha, because a malacha has to be constructive, deliberate attempt to assert human power over nature. Manipulate the forces of nature to make the world a better place. That's what we're supposed to do all week.
So destruction is not a constructive force.
Correct. Correct. Although this would hardly be a recommended way of spending the Sabbath, he says, and the act would in any case be prohibited under rabbinic safeguarding legislation. If, however, one were to do precisely the same act with the constructive purpose of clearing the site for rebuilding, one's act would be a malacha, and therefore would be prohibited. So now we're getting to a definition. I'm going to stop in a minute. We clearly see that it is the purpose that counts. And the malacha act can only be an expression of human creative intelligence if that purpose is constructive. Malacha thus includes within its scope any activity of constructive nature which makes some significant change in our material environment, significant, that is, in relation to its usefulness for human purposes. Any act, however small, which demonstrates man's mastery of nature in this way is a malacha. Be it a striking of a light, washing clothing, tying a knot, or building a house. We have thus arrived at the definition we have been searching for. A malacha is an act that shows man's mastery over the world, be it the constructive exercise of his intelligence and skill. Okay. Any questions? I'm hoping you're going to ask one question, though. Is there one... That's pretty clear, right? Is there one of those 39 activities that doesn't seem to correspond to this? Can anybody think of one of the 39 acts of work? Look at your sheets.
Erasing.
Oh, well, what's that?
Erasing.
Oh, because it's...
Sounds like
yeah, but you're doing it for constructive purpose.
Cutting.
Yeah, you gave it away. Barry.
It was a guess.
It's a good guess. How is carrying... Here's how you violate the malach of carrying on Shabbos. Here, the sheet. I put it in my back pocket. I didn't remember I had it in my back pocket. It's just a piece of paper. I walk outside. Let's say Manhattan never had an Erev. We could talk about what that is if you want. I walk outside my home. I walk outside. How have I manipulated the forces? How have I shown human power over nature? I haven't done anything. Carrying. It's so subtle. It's the easiest malacha to just do. Without even knowing you did anything, nothing changed. At least when I cooked something on Shabbos, I changed it, I manipulated it. The ground now is turned over, something is different. How is carrying doesn't seem to subscribe to this. So Rav Brunfeld says the following. Take a look on page 25. And not only does, by the way, oh yeah, take a look on 25. Special significance of carrying. If we consider the categories listed on page 22, we see all of them are clearly productive activities. But what carrying? No essential change, no productive process seems to be involved. So take a look at the bottom. He makes the question stronger by saying that when the prophet Jeremiah was told to warn the Jewish people that the future of the Jewish state depended on the way Sabbath was observed, and he was looking for one example of one malacha, he picks carrying. He says, if the Jewish people carry, forget it, there won't be a Jewish people anymore. Like, what? So take a look. Can anyone think, why is carrying forbidden on Shabbos? If somehow, this is an interesting theory. By the way, none of this is found anywhere in the Torah. These are great rabbinic thinkers that I'm sharing with you. It's their theories. But I really think Rabbi Diane Grunfeld's approach to the malacha is just so odd. And here's what he says about carrying. In the case of carrying, however, 27 on the right hand, bottom on the bottom, neither of these features is apparent. What's forbidden is what? What are you not allowed to do when it says you can't carry? You're not allowed to transfer an object from where to where?
The
private domain to the public domain. Can you carry inside your home, Jason?
Yes.
You may.
What about carrying from public to public?
Yeah.
Public to public is a problem. But you're starting to give it away. What's forbidden is to go from a private to the public or from point to point in the public. Okay? Oh, this is perfect. It's missing the last page. Oh, you got to be kidding. Stop!
What page was it, guys?
27.
Okay.
So
we need page
28. We need 28? So far, we're almost done. Oh, public. The exact evidence. Okay, so he says like this. We are dealing here with something different, which is clearly quite different from the realm of nature, if you can't carry. All the other 38 out of 39 deal with nature. Manipulating the natural world to make it usable for humans and to make the world a better place, manipulating, right? The house, the street, the city, carrying. These belong to another sphere, not nature, but human society. If the other melachot, says Rabbi Grunfeld, show us man mastering and controlling his natural environment, this one shows him active in the social realm, carrying on the intercourse of the community, circulating its material goods between house and house, through street and thoroughfare, not for trade only, but even for personal and social ends of everyday life. Carrying is the characteristic malacha by which man pursues and attains his purposes in society. By ceasing from each of the other malachot, the other 38, we proclaim God as the source of our power over nature. By ceasing from carrying, we acknowledge God, our master, in the sphere of human society. This vast, complex world of social organization, the world, house, street, and city, needs above all else the realization of God's presence, God's purpose, the sanctification, dedication, which ceasing from malacha expresses. The community whose members refrain from carrying on the Sabbath places the seal of God upon its social life. So the rest of the 38 is for the natural world. This is for the human world, the society. Can we now perhaps understand the emphasis on carrying in Jeremiah's message to the state of Judah? This is in line with the message of all the prophets, that Israel can exist as a nation only if it knows itself to be the people of God. And what can better express this dedication of the community than ceasing from carrying? Because what is it saying when you don't carry on Shabbos? It's saying, I am not going to continue to conduct my regular everyday business with my fellow human being. The other things are, I'm not going to manipulate the physical, natural world. Here, I'm going to relate to my fellow human being, but very different. We're going to make Shabbos, we're going to make Kiddush together, we're going to sing songs, we're going to have quality time, but we're not going to move things back and forth from my possession to his possession. That's the way business is done. That's the way the social intercourse of society takes place. The picture is now complete. The concept of malacha has been defined, and some of the ideas that may lie behind it have been sketched in. And, okay, so whatever, I can keep reading and reading. Any questions? Yeah, Barry.
Do we have to, like, after we did all those other malachas that I was carrying, you know, for the Mishkan, do we have to carry from wherever we did those things?
Oh yeah, it was one of the things. The reason carrying is prohibited is one of the 39 things that was done in the tabernacle. They would carry from different domains within the tabernacle. They were considered different reshuyot, different domains. There was public, there was private. Now, just so you know, also in Manhattan, I just remember when I grew up in. You guys familiar with the whole Erev thing? So an Erev permits you to carry. How? Anybody know how does it do that? Right, it makes the whole public private because it's just basically a legal definition of what public is. And as long as you can privatize it, which we do by putting a big string around, and it's a little more complicated than that.
So Manhattan is owned by the Jews.
We don't own that. That does not putting a string around the city does not give you ownership. What it does is that it makes it private according to the very narrow Jewish legal definition. It does. Now, you don't need to. When I grew up in Queens without an Erev, and I remember when I was 15 years old, the rabbi got up. It was a whole big thing. It took him a few years to build an Erev. It's a big deal. It costs a lot of money, time, and effort. You should just know, I used to collect, in my previous gig before MG, I used to collect the money for the Erev, and it was a whole to-do. Like, you know, because everybody, it gets checked every week. Somebody goes around and checks the Erev. You know, the Erev knocks down a few times. And my rabbi, he's a blessed memory, Rabbi Grimblatt, who I've shared with you before, was initially against the Erev in Forest Hills, where I'm from in Queens, because he was concerned two things. That number one, kids would grow up not even knowing that you're not supposed to carry on Shabbat, because it'll just be a lost melacha. The bigger issue he had was that it's inevitably going to go down at some point, if there's a storm or something. And then what happens when you're carrying stuff? Because I remember when I was like 16 or 17, he got up, and there was a big storm, shul was like half empty, and he said, listen, I know people carried, I'm leaving my office open, if anybody wants to go, and you know, take out all the stuff, your key, whatever it is, you know, I'm not looking who's leaving their stuff there, who's not leaving their stuff there, but I said this before we put the Erev up, that if it goes down, you technically can't carry. So you get very used to that. Now, you know, anybody know that sociologically the impetus for why? It was actually a very good reason. Why did we want to have an Erev then? Why don't we just let people not carry?
It encourages socialization on Shabbat.
And more specifically?
Food.
The women. Women. It was the women, the women, the women. Okay, you're thinking about, oh, when I go to the wilds, I want to bring my bottle of wine. Okay, yeah. But you can drop off the bottle before Shabbat or just not come on at all. But there was a much bigger impetus. sociologically in the Jewish community, women typically never came to shul because now things are a little different because men are taking care of kids just as much as women were, but it wasn't always like that. Ask your grandparent, your great-grandparents. Okay, if there was any, if your great-grandfather went to shul on Shabbat, when you were little, when their kids were little, who stayed home all the time? Because you couldn't bring the kid to shul. And as women became more active in the Jewish community, wanted to participate in synagogue life more, it was more of a push that there be an eruv so that the kids can be strolled to shul. And that I think that was the biggest impetus, and that's why I'm a huge... usually in favor of it.
Pushing a stroller is technically terrible.
Yes, yes.
What about carrying a baby?
Same thing.
Walking a dog?
No. That's a little more complicated. You're okay with that. But you can't pick up the dog and carry it.
So where do you think you get back into the building?
Is there an
actual stroller on the pad?
There is an actual.
Where is it?
It's between Riverside, and it actually encompasses Central Park. It got expanded over the years.
It's probably about that high. It's on poles, and it's wire, and it had to be.
We had to get approvals from the city. It was a whole big to do, and it gets. The synagogues get together and they pay and they have a fund, like anything else, to support the communal institutions. One of which is the Erev. So there's someone who drives around the city every Friday morning, everywhere the Erev is, and makes sure that it's intact. And I've gotten emails, and then, you know, the Erev is down this Shabbat. Also, sometimes, I think the Thanksgiving Day parade created some issues with the Erev in the city. There's also a big controversy about Manhattan, but we don't have time because I already got the look from, we started very late, though, I will tell you.
How far does it go from Riverside, like Riverside Park?
No, it includes Riverside Park. Right, it's before the highway.
The West Side Highway.
So you can't carry, if you want to start walking like on the shoulder of the highway, then you can't do that. You can, just don't carry anything.
By the river?
What's that?
It does not include Hell's
Kitchen.
It doesn't include
the
river.
Oh, it doesn't? You're looking at it?
It doesn't include Hell's Kitchen?
No, I think they expanded it.
Is that recent?
I think they've since expanded.
Was there another question here? Was there another? Yeah, Miranda, yeah.
Are you allowed to carry a prayer book on
Shabbat?
Sure. As long as it's an Erev.
You can carry anything that's not, and we'll talk about this in next week probably, that's not muktzah. Muktzah means something that's usually used for something that's forbidden on Shabbat. So, like, we don't write on Shabbat, so a pen becomes muktzah. So you couldn't really carry that around, even with an Erev.
What if you're not writing with a pen? You're emotionally...
Right. So I'm going to discuss that next week. You just like holding that pen, even though you're not going to write with it. It's still considered muktzah, but we'll talk about why that is. Yeah.
So like, I saw these men, like, how do they know for me, like, what actually practically how to keep Shabbat with all the things you don't do today? Like, for example, like, I heard about things like in the kitchen, you have to do certain things, how do we know from these what not to actually do,
so it's all derived from the activity that went into the building of the tabernacle. Anybody wants the? There's a whole set that describes this. Now what I'm going to do with you guys the next 2 weeks is I'm going to give you examples of, we're going to go through some of these melachot, specifically cooking, because I think it's very practical. And also we're going to talk about non-Jewish help as well. But basically, this is what the Talmud is for. There's an entire tractate with 24 chapters dedicated to the laws of the Sabbath. And in there, it will talk about what is plowing. Plowing is this activity. And then it'll bring up activities that partake of that physical activity. So if I'm not allowed to write on Shabbat, what does writing mean? Can I write a half a letter? Can I write one letter? Is it two letters? What about writing when it gets really foggy outside and there's snow on the car, and I want to write my name, Mark, on the car in the snow? Is that writing? It's not permanent writing. What constitutes writing? You literally have that question on each and every one of the 39 acts of work. And that's why each one of the 39 acts of work is a study and definitions. And it's not it's very detailed, but it's not that complicated once you figure out what each malacha really is, and then how it plays itself out in regular everyday life. Okay, you have an announcement.
Announcements, and then Allison will be teaching. Mm-hmm. Are you guys all looking at the air now?
Yes.
You sent it to everyone?
Yeah.
Tomorrow, if you guys read the emails, you know tomorrow we have the Whole Foods Seminar. 7 p.m. we're meeting at Whole Foods. Rabbi Avi will be there. Rabbi Marmorstein will be there. I think it's a really cool trip. Other people from MJ will be there.